Welcome to Open Support. Great to be with you today. As we get things rolling, I figured I'd show you guys the deal that we just bought. Potentially the best deal of the year so far. So here's the interior pictures. Here's our purchase settlement statement. So you can see our sales price history on the property of $340K. So we bought this for $340. Turnkey house is less than two years old. We put it on the market the same day at $535. Okay. So bought it for $340, put it on the market, $535 as is. We had some realtors tell us as high as $560, $570. We really didn't want to push that. And we were pretty happy with this one. Okay. Guys, if you have a question, raise your hand. They're in the group. And guys, also, if you are watching this on Instagram, YouTube, all the other places, you can jump on this call live by joining the Investor Creator Community on Facebook. So it's our free but private group. And we do this call now every 2 weeks. So Open Support, happy to talk about whatever you guys are wanting to talk about. Mamoon, what's going on, fellow?
Hey, Brad. How are you doing?
Good, buddy. How about you?
Doing okay. Will it be okay to ask the question that I posed, or Michael posed in the group, about the offer somebody made? You said, yeah, just passed on it. But more so, we're trying to understand what he really meant here. Is he trying to take over our mortgage?
Well, you know, that part is ambiguous to me, but the part of substitution of collateral is something that is frankly impossible to do on an owner finance deal anyway. I mean, you could subordinate or substitute your equity position in the deal, but for you to be in a position of like being able to do a true substitution of collateral, it just doesn't, it's not going to work. So that was the red flag for me where, you know, provision number one, notwithstanding provision number two, it's like, no, like it's not something that we would do as a seller. Yeah. As a buyer, potentially it's a good thing for us. But I would only do that if we had 0% money in on the deal. Does that make sense? So I mean, that's a problem with it in terms of my perspective is like having a substitution of collateral clause. Does everybody know what a substitution of collateral clause is? So a substitution of collateral clause allows you to change the collateral on the same loan. So if like we borrowed 100K on house A and we wanted to sell house A for 100 grand, we would not have to pay that 100K off. We could get the cash or whatever proceeds on that deal and then take that loan of $100,000 and put it towards a different property. So the lender does not have really the ability to control when they're paid off. And generally, the loan is going to go to term. Okay. And that's okay if we're borrowing 0% money, but we don't want to do that as the lender. So in this deal, Mamoon is the lender. Does that make sense?
Yes. To me, yes.
Okay, cool. So is that helpful?
Yes. I'm going to give back to you or can you take it?
Yeah, for sure. All right. Let me get the board back up here and we'll keep rolling. All right, guys, if you have a question, it's Open Support and no hands right now. So if you guys have a question, feel free to raise your hand. And happy to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about, marketing, negotiation, deal structure, what we're seeing in the markets. Let me just go through that really quick because it's really interesting. Everything that we're putting on the market is pending pretty quickly. And we are seeing for the first time, again, multiple offers. So I've been seeing some memes and stuff on Facebook that had some of the bigger talking heads about real estate. Some very, very smart people, frankly, like Patrick Bet-David, different people. Talking about, oh, the real estate market's going to crash, real estate market's going to crash. And frankly, had you asked me 3-4 years ago, hey, we're going to go from a 3% 30-year rate to an 8% 30-year rate, and then maybe back down to about 7, what's going to happen to pricing? I would have said, well, absolutely, price has to come down. You know, but we have not seen that. We're actually up 6% year over year as of right now in the real estate market. Okay. A lot of good things happening in the retail space, but it's one of those things also that I don't really care what kind of a market it is. You know, if I'm in a position where it's a 2010 market, that's when I started. It's really, really easy to buy, more difficult to sell, but owner financing solves that problem. If we're in a position where we're in a 2021 market, it's more difficult to buy. At least it is for a lot of investors, but we were able to buy a whole lot during that time. And it's really, really easy to sell. So keep in mind that whenever somebody says, oh, the market's good or the market's bad, it really depends on if you're a buyer or a seller. And because we buy and we sell, we're all the time caught between two separate markets. There's a market to buy and a market to sell, right? And so I think it's always really amazing whenever people say, oh, I'm going to wait for the real estate market to get better. It's like, better for who? You know what I mean? It depends on who you are. And if you're buying equity, then you can make a case that it's better to be in a good, more difficult seller's market. It's like, what is the definition of a good market? The definition of a good real estate market is a market you are effective in. And most people don't know how to be effective in a declining market. Okay. And guys, just to be clear, back in 2010, 2011, like wholesaling all but did not exist. You know, everybody wants to wholesale something. And I think that there's a time for that. That, you know, in 2010, there was foreclosures all over the place. Prices were down about 30, 35% across the country. Markets like Detroit, Las Vegas, Phoenix, South Florida were just decimated. I mean, far, far worse than 35%. And wholesaling all but did not exist because a house flipper, if you wanted to buy something, all you had to do is make blind offers on the MLS. You know, I had friends of mine back then that were making 100 offers a day and could buy a house a day. And they just would, you know, blind offer half and see what stuck. You know, that's not what we do. And that doesn't work anymore. And I saw a lot of people that, you know, it's like a who moved my cheese type moment. There were a lot of people that had that process that got to where it didn't work. Just like, you know, I was talking to a buddy of mine today, Matt, and we were talking about, you know, wholesaling to the REITs, the real estate investing trusts, the hedge funds. You know, they were coming in and in decent markets buying rentals for 100, 110, 115 cents on the dollar. You know, so it's very easy to wholesale deals to them because, you know, they were cash buyers, they were investors, they would do some fix up. And so, you know, and they would pay 100 cents plus on the deal. So people built their entire wholesaling operation around that type of process. But guess who's not buying houses anymore? I talked to the vice president of Progress Residential a couple of months ago. And he said that they went from buying 40,000 houses a year, 40,000, to they're going to buy about 2,500 to 5,000 this year. You know, and those are only where they were buying all over the place, Indianapolis, Nashville, Orlando. You know, they're in just a few certain markets that they really, really like now. Joel says, I hear BlackRock is still active. Yes, they are, but they're not as active as they were. I mean, you still have some hedge funds, some REITs that are still going out and buying, that they're not doing it at the volume that they were. But we are seeing for the first time some seed REITs that are coming into the market. They're tougher to find, but we are seeing them, but they're being ultra conservative. And the difference is the cost of capital. You know, the cost of capital went from, you know, below inflationary rates to something that now is difficult to cash flow. And there is a whole lot of concern around the commercial markets right now, commercial paper, you know, office buildings, multifamilies, because, you know, it's very common to buy multifamily and offices and that kind of thing on 5-year balloons, 7-year balloons, 10-year balloons. Very rarely do you amortize above 20 years, and even 20-year rates are not really advantageous for people to borrow that way. And so what we saw was, you know, rates, people are buying multifamily based on a 4.5% rate on a 5-year balloon. Well, those balloons now are coming due. And I'm seeing this in the markets. Yeah, I'm seeing this in the markets. And now people can't refinance the debt at all because, you know, the present value of these multifamily units have gone down because of cash flow. Yeah, and there are some big syndicators that are selling off properties, just trying to really break even. There have been big syndicators that have put non-refundable earnest money down on deals and have not been able to close those deals and losing. I mean, I know one guy recently that lost $250,000 in earnest money on a deal on a multifamily. You know, that hurts. You know, that hurts. So a lot of good things happening in the market, but you have to be careful. You know, but you have to be careful. We can't, just because we're in a good market, pay whatever you think you want to pay and add on $100,000 and think that it's going to sell. That worked in 2020, 2021. And there were a lot of investors that made very, very bad purchases at the beginning of their career that got saved because, you know, you could pretty much buy anything in 2019. And in 2021, you know, the equity happened in appreciation because, you know, the market just saved them. Okay. Hope is not a strategy. So we need to be in a position where we have a good working process to make decisions for us. That's tested by historical measures. So we want to buy in a way that works in bad markets, buy in a way that works in good markets, and everything in between. Okay. Hopefully that makes sense. All right, guys. Any questions? Yeah, COVID balloons are coming due. Okay. Joel Sanchez in the chat. Hi, Brad. Do deals like this one sold as is come by often? Yeah, I mean, whenever you have a good marketing budget, then these deals do happen. And now they're not usually 200K spreads. You know, that's a little bit abnormal. But we're seeing more and more deals that we're just buying and just putting on the MLS at sis. Okay. And those are always the best deals. You know, the no-haves. No rehab at all. Joel, go right ahead.
An idea with you.
Okay, I like ideas.
PPC has got the best ROI. PPC has got the best ROI. And I know I broached the idea in the past. PPC has got the best ROI. It's the most intention-based seller.
Yes.
It's motivation, fastest time to close. However, I rue getting phone calls at beep when I'm in the middle of my family time trying to figure out the scale. I ring inbound callers or clients from VAs in the Philippines call it. The ROI is lower, but I can get people to scale faster and easier because my cost per lead is $30 instead of $150, $200. So as a solopreneur or scaling profitably once you're up and running, PPC makes a lot of sense, but I might be a lower cost price per lead model, like getting some remote VAs to call just because I can train people at a much lower cost, and they can screw up faster without me burning so much money. What are your thoughts around that idea?
Gotcha. So it's a couple of different things. Okay. So number one, doing the offshore VA route as a process in this business. So I'll talk about that separately from really a work-life balance question, right? I think on the front end, there's no such thing as work-life balance. You have work-life choices. And the choice that you have to make is, am I going to get to this lead, even though, yes, it's family time and it's dinner time or whatever, am I going to get to this lead? Or do I understand that I could lose 50, 60, 100 grand by not doing that and be okay with it? Okay. I started off in my career doing whatever was necessary. Okay. And I'm very thankful that, you know, my wife and I dated from the time I was 19 on. And when I was 19, I was selling real estate as a realtor, and I had a model home. So I sold new construction and a new development. And, you know, she would remember that, you know, I would be at the model home on Sunday, you know, from noon to six. And, you know, if somebody came in at 5:59, I might be there until 8. And there were many times that we would be in a situation where we would have a date at 6:30, and I would call her like, hey, I'm tied up. And there would be no date that happened at all because I'm making a deal happen, you know. So, but she was okay with that. She understood that. And so whenever I transitioned from realtor to investor, then it was an easy transition for me from a family perspective. Okay. Now we didn't have children, but you know, from a relationship perspective, it was pretty easy for us to transition that way because she was used to it. But you know, the idea of like, hey, let's take a less efficient process and add it on because we have more control over time, I think is a difficult one. I mean, if you're going to hire a VA, I would much rather them be available during your off hours to run PPC as opposed to doing outbound calling. Okay. So that's a first point. Second point is hiring offshore and all of that. Okay. I find the VA model a difficult model to manage. Now, some people have done that. I'm great. I'm not a great manager. I'm a good visionary. I'm a good marketer. I'm a good buyer. But in terms of like me being the controller, that's not my personality type. Okay. And so the idea of me having 2, 3, 4, 5 offshore VAs cold calling, I have tried that and have not found it to be a working process. But here's what I do find is that generally speaking, the VA model is wrought with type 2 errors. So the idea of, you know, a type 2 error is like a type 2 error are unrealized losses. So a realized loss, you buy a house, you shouldn't have bought it, and you lose 40 grand. Okay. An unrealized loss is you didn't buy the house. You should have. You lost 40 grand. One comes out of your bank account. One is 40 grand that you don't realize. that you could have. And the issue that I see with VAs is they're continually like not running a process that is a working process. They're tough to manage and, you know, they're cold calling or whatever. And they're so much less effective than if you had people like in your office, even though they're more expensive in the US, they're more skilled, you know, and they're easier to manage. So that's my perspective on it. And, you know, happy to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I got to explore this. I mean, my level is I want to run fast, right? Brings back old memories, old days as a realtor calling spiders and FSBOs a big type in the phone,
yep.
Which is fine, right? Room and runway, but time for you. So it's a hell of a lot easier to deal with VA paying $5-6 an hour, paying $1,200 a month and buying a list for $1,000 and letting them pound the spinal dial. I can work with that easier than having somebody new, which obviously I'm not at the scale yet of having 4, 5, 6 homes generating $5 to $1,200 a month where I got cash flow to fuel the machine.
Yeah.
It's just an appealing idea that, yeah, it's not sufficient, but I could train somebody much less expensively to buy time back easier because it's much cheaper. So I'm just curious if you play with that and your thoughts. So that's
yeah.
How I want to approach it. So I appreciate the thought.
For sure. So, I mean, let me give you a scenario and tell me what you would do. So the VA is cold calling pre-foreclosures. It's Wednesday at 6 p.m. You're off hours and there's a foreclosure Friday and there's $150,000 in equity. So do you want that VA to like send you that lead for you to go and work at that point? Or are you just off the clock? You're done.
Well, I mean, not to be rhetorical, but I would immediately.
Yeah, and that's the way that I feel. And so if that's the case, then you really still have the same problem that you're still going to be available for the lead. And so if that's the case, then I would much rather have a VA that is available at $1,200 a month or whatever to do triage calls and then set you up perfect presentations during your time. And then they're also smart enough to say, hey, Joel, this is one we have to get to right now. I think that that's a better process in terms of both cost and quality.
I mean, just to follow on that point, not to be argumentative for the sake of being argumentative.
No, for sure.
That deal, 100%, I would want.
Yeah.
However, the majority of the deals, when, you know, what is that diamond in the rough deal? Probably 1% of fees come through. So the majority of the deals are run of the mill every day, operating day.
Yep.
Probably can wait a few hours, 6 hours until I get it. And maybe it's a simple SOP where I say, hey, listen, here's criteria. If there's more than 100,000 equity, call screen rights, smoke signals. I don't care.
Yep.
I don't know. But, you know, because obviously, well,
yeah. So here's the thing. Everybody has to make that determination for yourself. You know, right now, would I like want to be available for 30K deals? No. But when I started, I was like, who do I have to murder to get a 30K deal? You know what I mean? Like, give me their name. You know, it's not like that anymore. But, you know, if somebody had a 500K deal, Brad is always available. You can wake Brad up at 2 a.m. It's no problem. Right. But, you know, everybody has to make
that determination. Have you tried the model, the list of the VA model, or you just know people that have and some crash and burn?
No.
Some made it work. Have you tried it?
We have. We ran it for about 6 months, but it's been a long time. It's been probably 6 or 7 years ago. So potentially, I mean, certainly the market's different in that time. Potentially the lists are better now. So that's where I'm not 100% sure. Now, we have Jim that does outbound for us now, but he's US-based. So when I say this, it's not just because like I have this theory, you know, it's what I practice. You know, we have one person doing outbound, but I have 3 other people in purchasing doing inbound. Okay. So we are actively testing.
Yeah.
We're actively testing the outbound model again, but and it's not a bad model, you know, especially if you don't have the ability to go to paid ads. So it just comes down to, you know, you've got to start somewhere. Yeah, I started with bandit signs, you know, running bandit signs all over town at, you know, 2 and 3 a.m., but I was willing to do whatever it took. So, I mean, at the end of the day, everybody has to decide what you're willing to do in terms of work-life balance. And I'm not the person that says, hey, let's go make money to hell with everything else. You know, I believe in and I've gotten to where I hate this word because it seems like it's almost a cultural word now, but a holistic view on, you know, how we how we have a life. You know, it's not good to have a great business and terrible family life. You don't know your children, you know, you're overweight, you're sick. Like that doesn't sound good to me at all. But everybody has to make the determination on what are you willing to sacrifice in terms of time and money to accomplish what you hope to accomplish.
So your last thing is you mentioned to Matt that it feels like it could be another job, right? To manage all that stuff. So figure out time, work-life balance. Now you got one more job to manage, measure, monitor. Just figuring out that piece might not be worth the brain damage. So I agree.
That's right. And then also it's why we don't hire part-time people, unless they're interns. Like we have, two interns right now, you know, that are in college and, you know, working with us. I look at that as more of like a charity thing, like a give back. But, you know, we do not hire part-time people. And the reason for that is it's so much more difficult to hire and manage 10 part-time people at 20 hours a week than 5 full-time people at 40 hours a week. So it's going to be kind of the same issue, in my opinion.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right. Next, we have Gerald. What's going on?
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Perfect. Very good. Yeah, I have a deal I just wanted to run by you. Because it's a bit of an unusual situation. It's property in Louisiana,
okay,
close by the coast, and it has a very high insurance cost.
Yep.
So here are the numbers. I was just talking about it with James a little bit ago, but we thought we need to go to the show to get some input. We have to go with this one. So the mortgage is 202, walk away 220,000.
Okay.
No, actually, 220.
Oh, so just 20,000 on the walk away?
Just 20. Yes.
Yeah.
I misspoke. Repairs is supposedly only kitchen cabinets, but James always says 25 to stay alive.
25.
ARV is 260.
Okay.
And arrears 0. Now, there's a good interest rate on this property. It's 3.375%.
Yeah.
But the mortgage payment is $28.75 a month.
So how much is the insurance per year?
And that is, the insurance is $16,100 or perhaps even a little bit more. So it's $13.42 plus month.
Wow.
And that is the basic insurance is 11.4, but then there is a FEMA flood insurance, 4,700, something like that. And the reason is because it's like 50 miles off the coast and they have all these wonderful hurricanes in Louisiana.
Yes.
That always are attracted to Louisiana.
Yeah, they seem to be.
So this inventory, the property has been raised 4 feet through a government grant that has already been done. And the property is 2,900 square feet. It's 2,000 square feet for the main house. And it has an in-law suite. It is a separate kitchen, almost 100 square feet.
Got it.
That Porsche one recently.
Gotcha. So how confident are we in this 260 ARV?
Carl told me 259, but that's, of course, subject to confirmation.
Sure.
But this is what Carl told me.
I trust Carl, but even he would say, like, let's get local opinions. The reason I ask is, let's say that this is a neighborhood that has 700 houses and all of them require this flood insurance, and they all have a similar amount of insurance on the deal, then the insurance issue would really be baked in to the value if we have other comparables that are selling at 260 that have the same issue. And so if that is correct, then I would still be in a sub-3 situation. Okay, so we don't have price equity, meaning, you know, we're not buying this with a 30 or 40% discount, so we're not in a position where we can pay cash. This would be a sub-3 deal where we would buy at sub-2 and we would sell at sub-3 and, you know, move forward that way, because I just think it's too tight otherwise. And I think the $20,000 walk away probably should come down too.
Yeah, and I'm sure these open from the, they have not yet done the perfect presentation on it, but I wanted them to confirm some numbers, and I need to get some realtor input. Yeah, I think a subsidy would be the only way to go with this, but would you follow through with it?
So far, I'm not.
Is the deal good enough?
Yeah, I would be okay with it. So you mentioned the kitchen. Is there no kitchen, or is it like dated cabinets, and they think that they should come out?
It is. It's a house is from 79, and it has been largely renovated and updated, he says, but not the kitchen cabinets. And I'm not exactly sure what it means, but the house looks to be in good shape from the outside. But I've not seen pictures of the inside yet.
Yeah. So that being said, I'm okay to sub three this. Like, if there was no kitchen, then that's tougher. But, you know, based on this, I'm okay to move forward with it, with the idea of it only being sub three. So I would not do a sub two route on this.
Correct. I agree. Yeah. Okay. No, very good. Then, okay. Then I'll take it further. Appreciate your input.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. All right. Chris in the chat. Chris in the chat says, I spent $10,000 on VAs, and despite training and management from a real estate investor group, they never quite got it. Lots of non-motivated leads, and who knows how many unrealized losses. Yeah, that's probably true. But got one good deal, spent $4,200 on PPC and got three deals. Yeah. And $4,200 in three deals is slightly better than normal, but certainly within the realm of possibility, depending on what the market looks like. So that's kind of the difference, you know. And guys, keep in mind, I ran direct mail for years. You know, we were running 70,000 letters a month at one point, and it became so inefficient because, you know, 70,000 letters a month, you would have, I don't know, 3% call rate at that point. So that's, what, 2,100 calls. So 80 or 70 calls a day, 70 calls a day. So I would have, you know, two full-time people and one part-time person on the phone, and a third of those 2,100 calls, so let's just call it, what, 600-700 calls, are 700, are angry that you mailed them. So imagine being in a process where you're getting 700 calls a month from people that are yelling, cussing. We had a wall of shame in the office where people would mail us obscenities written on our own letter. They would mail it back to us. Funny, you know, so I got to the point where I just wanted an efficient process that, you know, we're generally, last month we were over KPI, we're at 17 leads a contract. But still, I mean, that's still not terrible. You know, 17 leads, you probably talk to 12, you buy one. So it's very efficient in terms of time. Okay. So if you're wanting to buy two houses a month, all you got to do is generate 30 to 35 leads as an average. Okay. 30 to 35 leads. That's at most one conversation a day. So it's very efficient in terms of that. All right. Michael, my main man in the chat. Good to see you too, buddy. He says, please talk to me a little bit about selling partials. Is it just selling, say, 5 years of cash flow with some sort of a discount? If it's a sub two deal, do I have to wipe out the underlying mortgage first? So it depends. So generally speaking, if you sell a wrap, they're going to want to pay off the first. So, but some note buyers will buy a wrap and discount it. Okay. So could you, in theory, sell a wrap, sub to a first or multiples, but let's just say a first, and sell that on a partial? Yes. Okay. A partial is when on a term of a note, you sell off the front of the payments, but, and that's at least how it's generally done. You could do it however you wanted. So I've seen people do split deals. So like, let's say they have a note that cash flows $1,000 a month, but they need cash. They may sell a partial called a split, where the first $500 on each payment goes to the money lender or the partial buyer, and then $500 per month goes to the note holder. You know, so you could do that. You know, so you could do that. You can sell the tail. You can sell the middle. You can sell the front. You know, whatever can be negotiated can be done. Okay, but it's typical that you're in a position where you sell a partial on a wrap, they pay off the first so that they have more security being in first position. And it's usually the first group of payments, because those are the payments that are worth the most. Okay. Good question. Yes, sir. You're welcome. Brian, how's it going?
Good, Brad. How are you?
Doing okay.
Good. Hey, quick question on Gerhard's deal there. Oh, so what are there typical factors that you see when you, when something's flashing, you have, this should be a subject, this should be a sub three instead of a sub two?
Yeah.
The price difference, is it just a risk because of the insurance in the area, the flood, FEMA and all that, or what tips you offer that should be sub three?
Yeah. So there's going to be a few things, and this is not an all-inclusive list, but I want you to kind of see how we think about it. So the first thing I'm going to look at is there equity? If there's deep equity position in terms of price, then I'm going to move forward on the deal. Okay. And just buy it sub two. If it's a deal where it's turnkey and we have a 3% rate like this, then I'm going to go ahead and probably go ahead and buy it. This one has an X factor. It has a wild card with this insurance. And the first question I had was, okay, how do we feel about the value? Is the value really 260? You know, because let's assume that we change it a little bit. Okay. Let's say the repairs are, to owner finance it, really zero, because we don't have to fix up property to owner finance it. And the walk away was $5,000 and we did not have this insurance issue. I would absolutely buy this right now. You know, so that's kind of the difference between where we were and where I need to be for me to like it enough to close it. You know, if it's 15 walk away without the insurance deal, then I would still probably close it, depending on what it looked like, you know? So, you know, for me, this one, it's just too tight with the insurance issue.
Gotcha. So with something like you're going to own or finance it that has that kind of X factor with the insurance and the flush and everything else, when you're comparing, or when you're maybe it's just a general question, when you're selling owner finance, are you, how much of that do you bring to the buyer that, hey, the our owner finance portion of you is only going to be $2,000 a month, but you have to go find insurance, you have to go find all the other things. Do you give out approximate ranges of what it is now, or is that all up to that? Like, how do you approach it?
We really can't, man, because more and more insurance is credit score driven. So, you know, if I felt like potentially it was going to be an issue, then you know, I wouldn't tell the buyer this, but internally I would be thinking, you know, if they can't get affordable insurance, you know, whatever it is for them, then I'll be willing to let them out of the deal. Right.
Okay. But so you bring it to them that, hey, this is going to be this is your interest in principle. That's your payment to us. And then you have to find your insurance. So
yeah.
They are there. They go find
it. Yeah. Taxes are this right now. You know, so my conversation with the buyer is, you know, we're doing the loan. The principal interest amount is, you know, a fixed payment if it's a fixed rate. Okay. It's a fixed payment. What's not fixed is the escrow. So taxes and insurance generally go up over time. So right now the taxes are this. What I don't know is how much your insurance is going to be. Because again, more and more insurance is credit score driven. And I don't want to tell you something that's going to end up being wrong. So do you have an insurance person, or would it be okay if I had you talk to one of the people that we recommend? So then that way I'm trying to get my people in because I know that they understand how to do the insurance with stuff too.
Okay. Thank you.
Cool. Good question. All right. Could be winding down today. See if there's anything else in the chat. I think we're good. Jonathan, go ahead. At the buzzer.
Hey, Brad, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
Good. So I've got a deal here. Are you familiar with Loretto, Tennessee?
I'm not.
Okay. Well, anyways, here's the deal. So there's no mortgage. The ARV is around 345. It's turnkey, no repairs, no arrears. And I got her down to around 311 walkaway. So 200K now. And $1,000 a month till paid.
Okay.
Now, like, she's really motivated. Like, I'm sure she's going to go for the payments. But in any case, she wants to go for the lump sum. How would you structure this?
Lump sum of the later money?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, right now, I don't think I can do this. So, like, kind of what I say is a maximum on some now, some later is half at closing. and then balance in the future. So, you know, that would put us, you know, we're 40 grand off. Let me just call it, you know, 150 now and 150 later. You know, something like that is starting to approach something that would potentially work. But, you know, right now, I think this is really tough. So, you know, congratulate yourself that you negotiated a some now some later deal. We just may have to go back to the drawing board and like, hey, you know, looking at this, it just really doesn't work. You know, if it was 100K now and the balance at $1,000 a month, this is a grand slam deal.
Okay. So in any case, if that 200, if I can get it down to 150, this is something you'd be interested in?
Yeah. I mean, at 150, I think it works, but that's the max. That's the nosebleed. Everything else has to be correct. Days of market has to look good. It has to be turnkey. It has to be in a good area, like near a decent metro. Like all of that has to be correct. Otherwise, yeah, it's really going to be difficult.
Okay. And then I have another deal I'm working on. It has like a split parcel lot. It's like half an acre, but it's got, you know, 0.25 acres on the whole. And then a 2.5 kind of on a like big garage, a shop area, if you were to call it. Does that have to get like purchased separately on different agreements, or can that be on all one? It doesn't have a different address.
Yeah. So if it's a different deed, then it doesn't have to be on a different PSA, but you want to, in paragraph 10, because I know you're using my paperwork, say house and garage on half an acre. So you're describing what you're buying. Does that make sense?
Right. Okay. So like obviously online, like Rob Shane, but like you can see the lines on it, right? It's like kind of split into two.
Yep.
But I just want to make sure that I'm buying both, not just the home.
Well, and I've seen it done this way as well, where there's one deed, but two separate legal descriptions. And so you have underlying lot lines on one deed, you know, let title deal with that, but make sure like, here's what not to do is what I did about 3 years ago. We bought a double wide on 14 acres. And it was 7 acres on parcel one with the double wide. And that's where the address was, and 7 acres next to it. And what we didn't do was put in the PSA, you know, double wide and 14 acres. And so whenever we bought it, the deed was signed by the seller and it was just for parcel one. And so when we went back to them and said, hey, you forgot, you know, there's an issue. We have parcel two as well. They're like, oh, no, that wasn't included. And we lost the 7 acres, and it cost me 70 grand. But luckily, I still had about 70K in equity in deal number one, in parcel one. So that was a type two error. That was an unrealized loss. So I did not have a good day that day. But I remember being mad about it for about 15 minutes. And I was like, you know what? I'm really blessed that I could be in a situation where, you know, effectively my balance sheet goes down 70 grand. And it's like, it's okay. You know, it's not what you want, but it's okay.
Right. Okay. So I guess just having that special provisions, you know, house and carport garage.
Yeah. And so you want to tell the title company when they do the deed, make sure that it's two separate parcels. So it'd be legal description number one, legal description number two.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it, Brad. Thank you.
Anytime, dude. Rock and roll. All right, Brian, how goes it?
I'm in deal. You got on the board right there.
Yep.
So say you got the sub now, sub later, it's in the max 50% ballpark, just say it's 150 to walk away with $1,000 a month till paid.
Yep.
I can do some more reps on sub now, sub later in general to better understand, but what would an exit look like for this that makes sense?
Yeah. Cool.
That are you gonna own or finance this?
For sure.
And try to make that work or?
Yeah. So let's go through the numbers. So if the ARV is 345, I'm going to bump it for under finance. So my OFV is going to be 37. Okay. Down payment of 37,000.
Sure.
So I'm pretty terrible at math. Let me actually get my calculator. So 370 minus 37. 333. So let's just call it 335 on the note once you have your loan origination fee. So if we run 335 on a mortgage calculator to come up with a payment. So $335,000 on a 30-year note at 8% is $2,458. So that's the amount of principal interest coming in on the deal. Does that make sense so far?
Sure.
Okay. So now we have to see, how do we make money on this deal? Okay. It's going to be tight. So if we borrow the $150,000 at 12%, then we have a $1,500 principal interest. I'm sorry, just an interest payment, which would be okay, but really we want to amortize it. So let me run it on a 20-year. So $150,000.
Why would you amortize across 20 years for that, so that you have a 10-year delta on the back end? Is that the idea?
Well, that is correct, but I'm trying to make my first concern is, number one rule of deal structure, no negative cash flow. So I'm trying to make it to where this deal at least breaks even. So I've got here, and this is why I did it first, I've got $2,458 coming in that I could work with to make this deal cash flow, okay, or at least break even. So $150K, 20-year term, 12% is $1,651, okay? And then if we ran, let's say we got really, really good some now, some later on the $150 later, and we got it at $750 per month. Okay, which can happen. I've had deals like that. So let's calculate our cash flow. So 2458 minus 1651 minus 750. So we're at $57 per month in cash flow. Okay, so we broke even. But we got paid $37,000 on the front end with the down payment. And then our note starts off at $335. So $35,000 in note equity day one, right? But let's say in 10 years, this thing fast forward 10 years and this thing pays off. Then you have how much equity appreciation in the deal, ballpark, okay? So 750 times 120, you've got $90,000 in additional equity in this deal, okay? So, you know, we got paid $37,000 up front to put the deal together. We're basically break-even cash flow. You know, in 10 years, the $100K private money loan that we put in at 12% might be paid down to 100. And then, you know, we have $90,000 of additional pay down principal on the later money. Okay. So that's a good ballpark understanding on how to create something like this. So, you know, and again, this is absolute max. You know, 150 now, 12%, we can make that work. You know, this is why the maximum has to be half down.
Sure. And will you try to amortize the private money as short as possible while still maintaining some kind of positive cash flow? Is that the idea behind that?
It depends on what the business needs. Generally, yes. You know, I'm okay at this point. Like, there are some deals that I have that are rentals that are negative cash flow. But as a portfolio, we're still positive cash flow. You know, so if we have, let's just make up numbers. We have $1,000 worth of cash flow, and we have a deal that's negative 90, but it has deep payoff, then we would still bring that in. You know, but the surest way to create long-term wealth is to have deals that are positive cash flow that you hold over time. You know, so that's why number one rule of deal structure: no negative cash flow. So generally, I'm going to try to get that private money because the money's expensive. You know, we don't want to just do interest only. We want pay down.
Yeah. Okay. When you calculate the back end of the actual cash in your pocket, you're saying you're taking in 37 because all 150 is coming from the private money. So you're not factoring that in. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, we could put the 37 down on that deal and our cash flow would be a little bit better, but not much.
Gotcha. This, misunderstood, we said that paid out. So, like, if you're carrying something that's negative cash flow, even that, you know, $90 a month, but you're saying the pay down or payout down the road is huge. What is that? Well, I don't think I fully understand.
Yeah.
So that the equity at the back end after the private money's paid off, then you have a huge spread on cash flow.
Yeah, so that's generally happening on a some now, some later deal where, like, let's say on this deal, it was $20,000 now, but $2,700 a month. Okay, so it's really easy to get into on the front end, but I'm negative cash flow each month, but it's almost all for savings. Does that make sense? So that's a scenario where we would still do the deal, even though it's negative cash flow right now. But I wouldn't have done that my first deal because I couldn't. Yeah. You know, I couldn't have done it.
No.
But I just would like on that. Do like, would we ever retail some now, some later deal?
Yeah, if you had deep equity and let's say that the seller became a pain or there's some X factor, you know, then yeah, I mean, I would not say that we would never do it, but it is rare because what you do not want to do is extinguish 0% money.
Right. And that's the reason you're owner financing.
Correct. Or holding it as a rental. It's just that generally with owner finance, we're being paid up front to take the note. Where a rental, you're all the time having to feed that. Mm-hmm.
And in any case, when you bring in a private money at 150, wouldn't they require some down money?
Not at all. I mean,
factored in, obviously.
The conversation with the money person would be, hey, I've got a deal. I'm owner financing it at 370. I need 150 in first position. Are you interested? It's like, well, they're at a 1/3 loan to value. Or not quite that, but maybe 40, 43%. So they're in a very safe position. You know, the reason that private money people generally want money down, of course, skin in the game, yes, but you know, there's a point where the safety is so high that they'll go 100%.
Okay. All right. So in any case, yeah, this is much like safer for a private money lender than rather than a rehab.
Absolutely.
Just like turnkey.
Yes.
Okay.
Not in the same conceptual universe. Yeah.
Cool. Right.
For the some later money, that's the 150 on the back end. Yeah, I gotta go back through that part of the curriculum again. So that's tied up by just a promissory note. That's not an actual lien on the property, right?
Correct. So I've no only position
on that back 150.
Yeah. So okay. They have a note, but not a security instrument. And the only time that I've had to pay interest, I've paid interest twice, I think. I was trying to think if there's a third time. I think it's just twice. Both of them were lake houses that I wanted personally. So there's this X factor that I had to buy this lake house. So paid some interest.
Since it's a promissory note, obviously you'll have some kind of terms, details in there. Did you ever write the promissory notes that that you don't have to pay them off if he didn't sell the property? So say he retails out of this, he can just keep that 150 as a promise.
So
sorry, don't still pay them down per the terms of the agreement, but not have it tied to the sale of the property. So you have 0% money to carry forward in your business.
So that's done automatically by not having the security, the deed of trust or the mortgage on the property. Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
That's a good point. For my newer people, if you look at this, it's like, what in the hell is going on this board? That's normal. You're not supposed to understand this unless you've been training on it for a little while. You know, I can go through these numbers very quickly now, but that's 14 years in. You know, whenever I started, it was, what is that number again? So, and I came from accounting. Guys, that's going to be it for us today. I've got a hard stop here in 5 minutes for an employee introduction. New guy joined with us today. I appreciate you guys. We'll be on with you guys during a couple of weeks. Y'all take it easy. Tag me in the group if you need me.
See you next week, man.
See y'all.